Well, hello and welcome to the live stream event today, 18th of September 2018. It's Martin North here from Digital Finance Analytics. Thank you very much for taking time out of your evening to spend time with me, and I hope that we'll have an interesting and productive conversation over the next little while. Just by way of background, the concept here is that I'll run through some material, but also engage in some conversations and a little bit of chat as we go. And hopefully we'll, drum roll, says Bruce. Yes, indeed. Hello, Gareth. Yes, 5,200. It's pretty good, Raku. I'm not at work this time. Good. Okay. Hello, Martin. Hello, Royce. A few others as well there. Okay. So here's the plan. I'm going to, as normal, just run through a few slides and use that as a basis for the conversation. I'll be looking at the chat as we go. Gambling is bad. Yes, Braves. I think I agree. That's why I didn't take up the take up the challenge. Oh, it's all good fun, isn't it? Okay, so let's just switch across to the presentation screen. Okay, so, and I've got the audio sorted out this time, which is good, so hopefully we won't have any nasties on the audio. And I'm also streaming at 1080 rather than 720 this time. We've got some of that sorted out too, so hopefully you've got me in high def, which will be good. So what I'm going to do is just go through some of the running order, first of all, as normal. It's pretty straightforward, this introduction. I'll talk about the house rules just briefly. I'll talk about our models again, just because a number of new people are joining, and as a result of that, they may not understand a little bit about the models. I'll then run through some slides. There are a few more than six, but I said six or so. And there'll be plenty of time for Q&A. I will look as I go. John Adams has joined. Hello, John. Good to see you. Great to have John on board as well. Lazy Postman. Genevieve, a few others too there. Okay, questions and answers, and then there'll be a sign-off, probably about an hour, give or take, as normal, unless we get into some really deep conversations, in which case it might take a little longer. As always, just the house rules. Please note this is not financial advice. I have to say this every time. I'm not qualified to give financial advice. Don't take it as a financial advice. It's my own opinions. It's based on analysis, based on my research, but please do not take it other than that. Please play nice in the chat room. If we have any shenanigans, I'll be moderating it, but to the last two times, got some good 457 sound engineer. Well, I hope the sound's all right, because Oliver's saying New Zealand house prices are going down. Yeah, I hope the sound's sorted out. I discovered last time I was putting it through my switcher and then into my second switcher, which actually is the one that then streams, and it was amplifying each time I did it, which is why it sounded a bit nasty. This is, of course, as at the 18th of September 2018. Things may change after that. You know, if you're watching this 5 years later, who knows? Did we have a crash? Did we not have a crash? I don't know. Please use Walk the World. If you want to get my attention, there's a lot of people on the stream, and I won't necessarily be able to catch everybody's comments on everything. So at least if you put at Walk the World, then you will get my attention. So on the model, this is the way the model works. So we have information coming in from our consumer surveys, our other surveys, plus other client anonymized data. That goes into our core market model. That's the fundamental analytic tool that we use for all our analysis. That also includes information from the industry, RBA, APRA, ABS, as well as company trading statements. And out of the back of that comes a whole lot of sausage machine outputs from the mortgage industry reports, from all the other stuff that I put on blogs and on YouTube, as well as customer clients. So that's the way the model works. I just want to recap on that because I keep saying I am data driven. I'm driven by information. And unlike a lot of opinions out there in YouTube land and elsewhere, this is actually driven from information and from data. And we can slice and dice the data all sorts of different ways, by segments, by location, by geography, by property status, a bunch of different things. And that's a bit of a Rubik's Cube that I can mess around with in terms of looking at the different data. John, you've got a precious girl, says you're brilliant. Well done. Okay, so just in terms of a few things that you may not have seen yet, the RBA minutes came out today, and there were 3 points that I picked up. Firstly, They are saying that the demand for new housing has eased somewhat. Off-the-plan sales of new apartments have declined as a result of weaker demand from domestic and investors and foreign buyers. And I'd add, I've had conversations in the last couple of weeks with several developers, all of whom are absolutely desperate to sell. And what they're doing there is discounting heavily by up to 20%. They're guaranteeing rentals for the first 5 years if somebody buys. And in some cases, they're now leasing the properties on a short-term basis because they can't sell them. And several people said that three people have actually now stopped buying new land. Want a dinner with Steve Keen or Martin Armstrong? Okay, very good. Okay, second point. Established housing market conditions continue to ease. House prices are falling. We'll touch that a bit later in terms of the momentum. But they did also make the point that house prices in Perth are also declining. And of course, Perth's had a long, slow decline over a number of years. And it's very interesting how the real estate guys keep saying, it's going to be going up, it's going to be going up. And I keep saying, no, it's going to be going down. ETA, I have to buy four investment properties tonight, said Gareth. About an hour, I think, we'll spend on this. And the third point, interest rates are rising from the funding pressure. Lenders accounting for 40% of outstanding housing credit lifted rates. Of course, that'll create a small rise in the average outstanding variable rate loan. And that, they said, unwinds half of the decline observed in the average housing loan rate over the preceding year. Ross has asked, would you buy gold? Okay, well, we'll talk about that a bit later. Now, this is data today from the ABS on house price growth trends. And the thing to highlight is that if you look over here, going down is the message, going down. The only one that's going up is Hobart. These are annual growth rates. So that's continuing what we knew to be the case. And this is, of course, the ABS data, so it's till June. It's somewhat old, but nevertheless, it's still highly relevant given the situation. Another way of looking at it is the annual price movements. So this is effectively the annual rate of change. And you can see there that Sydney's down 3.9, Darwin's down 6, and Hobart's up 15. On average, across all the capital cities, down 0.6 over the year. But of course, those averages are relatively meaningless. And the second one is this is the quarter. So this is effectively what happened last quarter. And people need to understand that we are seeing a very significant decline now. You know, it's happening. And in fact, the latest data from CoreLogic, which is a bit later than this, shows showing further decline. So Hobart, quarterly, 3. Sydney down 1.2 on average. Melbourne down 0.8. So, question, Martin, do you think the depression in prices will hit regional areas to the same extent as the capital cities, Portly 777? To an extent, yes, but not quite as much because we haven't had the huge uplift. But I'll show you some regional data soon that shows that there is also some issues there, I think, as well. Next one. This is, I think, killer slide. What are your thoughts on guys like the property coach who continue to spruik the market? Yes, a lot of spruikers around. Frankly, I think that it's overdone. And here's the reason. This chart here, shows the number of transfers quarter on quarter from the ABS. And this is looking at the March quarter and the June quarter. So the blue bars are the March quarter. The red bars are the June quarter. And can you see the significant declines in the number of transfers? That's the bottom line. So all this talk about auction clearance rates, all this talk about house prices, this tells you better than anything else what's happening. There are less transactions going through the system. And not just a little bit of a drop, but you can see here, rest of New South Wales down 16%. Last quarter and 5% this quarter. But look at Victoria and Melbourne. We're seeing significant drops there, as we are in Queensland. So Queensland is now dropping significantly. And Hobart is also down 28%. And 28% and 30% for the rest of Tasmania, and down 10% for Hobart, although up a little this time around. And Darwin, of course, is down, and there was a drop in Canberra last time, a little offset this time. Now, this is interesting because it takes a few months for all the data to flow through into this information. So that basically says that there is significant reduced transaction volumes in the system. And the reason for that is there's less demand, of course. Okay, now this is CoreLogic data come out recently on total returns. So the total returns index is taking account of the annual value changes and the analyzed growth rentals. And they make the point that dwelling values are falling, gross rental yields are close to historic lows, so therefore the total returns are actually less attractive. Nationally, values have fallen by 1.6. Total returns have fallen by 1.9, and that is relative to 14.2% a year ago. And the falls are more significant in the capital cities relative to the regions. So picking up the other point, okay, well, somebody's asking me, I'm a first home buyer and I average job to buy or not to buy. Yes, well, my own view is you probably, if you wait, will be able to buy for less. That would be my suggestion, because I think prices are going to go on down. All the data here is saying more falls ahead, but you know, you have to do your own work. I can't give you advice. So the point there is that the regional prices never went up as fast, so they've got sort of less gravity to defy. But we also noticed that the rental returns in regional areas are also going down as well, which is why even in regional areas, the total returns index is also falling. Now, this is another piece of data, again from CoreLogic. This is about the percentage of sales that are actually sold above or below where they were bought. And this is quite interesting data just out. So you can see here the red bar is June quarter 17, the blue bar is June quarter 2018. And the point to make there is in some centres, considerable proportion of properties are actually now being sold at a loss. Less so in and around Sydney, although it's rising from 1.8 to 3.1. But if you look at, for example, Perth, more than half are actually now being sold at a loss. And even in Melbourne, these are units, in Melbourne Inner, 22% of units are being sold at a loss. This is, again, another critical leading indicator to make the point that there are things happening which are quite unique in the market at the moment. The proportion of loss-making sales at 10.2%, says CoreLogic, was the highest level since the 3 months to October 2013. So you can begin to see that effectively, if you're holding units in some of these areas and you need to sell, you're going to sell at a loss. Are the sold at a loss figures self-reported? No, they're actually generated by CoreLogic. So they actually know in the data feeds they get the price of the transaction and then the price of the next transaction. So they're comparing the two transactions. So no, it's not self-reported. It's actually CoreLogic data sucked out of their various sources. Okay, now credit is still growing, and this is the interesting thing, right? So if you look at this chart here, the blue line, this one here, credit overall is still growing at 5.5%, but of course it's coming down. But look at the investor line. This is the investor 12-month. This is from the RBA at 1.5. Owner-occupied credit, though, is still growing at 7.6%. And in fact, the annualized 5.5 is just 5.6 last month, 5.5 this month. So we've still got a lot of credit in the system. But the critical thing to understand here is that for house prices to continue to grow, you have to have growth in credit. You can't just have credit maintaining at the same level. You have to have an acceleration in credit, as Steve Keen made the other day when we were talking, the point he was making when I was talking with him. Okay, LD's asking about bail-ins. I'll talk about bail-ins. Every time I talk about bail-ins, but I will talk about them later, so I haven't forgotten, but I'll just finish my presentation here. So this tells me that we are still in a situation where there's still much too much credit being offered. Another measure, mortgage stress, is still up. And as I think I've said before, it's really interesting. If you sort of draw this line through here, So go back to 2009 and onwards, you can see that this long-term trend has been growing. It went down because rates were cut and the lending standards were very much looser, but we're now back to tighter lending standards, so that's why we're on that track. So that 30.5% means around a million households in difficulty. Somebody's asking there, should banks be a public utility, not for profit? Interesting question. I think there's room definitely for a public bank. Personally, I think that if banks do the right thing on the right basis and they make a reasonable profit, that's a different from where they've been. So we could come back to that perhaps a little bit later. Okay, BBSW, just on this, it's easing. So this is the bank bill swap rate. It was up at 30 at one point, so the compression in the bank funding is still there. But that's still enough to create a problem because the rotation of 90-day, particularly 90-day funding, continues. So every 90 days, they have to actually go get more funding just to support their current book. And every time they do that, they have to pay more for it, which is why there's continuing pressure. Oliver St. John says, push up interest rates. And Roy says, I need to read quicker. Oh, sorry, I'll try and go a bit slower in that case. I'm trying to get through this so we can have more time for the discussion. Nearly there. This is another really important point. So every quarter, APRA publishes data on the property statistics in the banks. And this is one of the most interesting charts. This is the measure of new loans written outside serviceability standards. Now, I would have thought, that given all the tightening and everything else, that you would have seen the loans outside serviceability dropping considerably. But no, look at this. The banks, the major banks, and this is as to June, the major banks have 6% of their loans now being written outside standard serviceability. Would money be safer in a member-owned bank? I'll come on back to that shortly. It's all part of the bail-in conversation. I'll come back to that. So this is the point here. The outside serviceability is worse. So what's happening is they've lowered their standards, but then they're actually breaking their own rules. And I find that pretty amazing. So with that background, I want to talk now specifically about home prices and lead into the conversation about the 60 Minutes program, right? Because I think what's an ADI, says Mike? Authorized Depository Institution, a.k.a. a bank. APRA calls them ADIs, so I'm afraid I've got into the habit, but it's a bank. And a bank, by definition, takes deposits on one side of the equation and then lends out, but of course we know there's no direct connection between the two from earlier conversations. Banks can create money out of thin air. Okay, so here's two ways to think about house prices. The first way is what I call price discovery. Price discovery basically is I'm trying to sell, I've got lots of buyers, there's an auction, and there's a haggle, and a price is set. And in a rising market, in a buoyant market, price discovery tends to be the way that it works. Think of the stock market the same way, right? So price is effectively the point at which somebody sells and somebody buys. That's the price at any given point in time. But ask yourself this question. Why in a crash is it feasible? Richard's saying, RBA says that mortgage repayments proportion of income are still lower than pre-GFC levels. How does that reconcile with the higher mortgage stress? Simple, Richard. Flat incomes, rising costs, bigger mortgages. And the data that the RBA is talking about is 3 years old because it's old Hilda data. Okay, so price discovery is one way, but price discovery only really works in when a market is sort of fully functioning. And ask yourself this question, how come on one day, if there's a stock market crash and prices drop 20%, they can next day be 20% lower? That's because price discovery is very little to do with fundamental value. And you can talk about EPS and other measurements, but if price discovery is driven largely by sentiment. And that's what we've had. Now, the other way to think about prices is to think about, if I wanted to get some land and utilities and fees and put it all together, what would it cost? I can think about the construction costs and other inputs, and I can think about the amenity value. So things like, is it on the coast? Is it on the rail station? Is it, all those things, right? And that gives you a sort of a set of values that effectively is not directly correlated to price discovery. Okay, you could say the land might be, and I agree that, but it's a relatively smaller segment, right? Now, if you run this calculation on home prices, and I'm using Sydney as an example, currently we have a 40% gap between price discovery and any logical common sense view as to what it would take to build a place on a plot, right? So that 40% is why I'm arguing that there's a considerable risk of a considerable drop. That's one way of doing it. The other way of doing it is this. So you can also look at ratios. So you can look at home prices to income. And this is data from Endeavour Equity Strategy. It shows you that in Sydney, the median house price to median income is about 12 times. In Melbourne, it's about 11 times. And you can see that in Brisbane and Perth, it's a little lower. The ratios need to adjust by around 40% in Sydney and Melbourne, 20% in Brisbane and 15% in Perth to get back to long-term sustainable levels. Michael is asking about Bitcoin. Yes, I'll talk about Bitcoin a little bit later too. I'll write that down and talk about it shortly. Now, put all that together and then think about what's been going on. We've had tighter lending standards, focus on income and expenses, not HEM. Household expenditure measure, for those who may not have been following the argument. We've had mortgage borrowing power drop by 40%. We've had foreign buyers drop by 35% and significant heights in extra fees and taxes. We've had the self-managed super fund borrowing restricted, Westpac and CBA. CBA announced this week. Interest-only borrowing restrictions, there's $120 billion for reset each year ahead. We've had investors who are less likely to transact as capital growth reverses. We've got tighter returns on rentals. Half of those rentals around the place are underwater in cash flow terms. So if you don't see the capital growth, you don't really have a proposition. There's higher interbank funding costs. We've got rising mortgage costs and rates. Remember, of course, NAB held. And there's also risks from the class actions and from the Royal Commission. And I could go on. Put all that together and you can begin to see why it is that we have considerable issues in the works. Now, 60 Minutes. I don't know how many of you saw the 60 Minutes. There's a story here. I was rang up about 2 months ago and they asked for my opinion about the housing sector. They decided to do something on housing, but they didn't know what to do. So I gave them some clues as to how to think about it. They then went away and went quiet for a couple of weeks and then came back and said, OK, we think we've got an angle. So I went up to Sydney and we recorded a few different things. And I'm just going to switch. I'm just switched back. There you go. You can watch me for a little bit. I'll come back to the slides in a second. So basically, they then went away and did some more research and they came back and recorded a second round of conversation with me down here the week before last. And they'd made a journey of discovery because basically the producer said to me, I don't really think there's a story here. You know, there's not much to say. Whereas Stuart's Byrne Jones, did you see Nine News this evening? House owners and home builders are selling their houses with additional bonuses such as cars, worldwide flights. Absolutely. Loads of incentives. Like I said, they're discounting heavily. Desperation stakes. So 60 Minutes then did their recording. I went through my four scenarios, and those of you who've been following the work here, you know that I talk about business as usual, things can only get better, not yet doomsday and Armageddon, right? So those are the four scenarios. And the fact of the matter is that I went through all those four scenarios, and then they basically settled on the Armageddon, which is the 40 to 45. And then they got the other guy to talk about, Louis Christopher, to talk about 40% too. So their 40% was my worst case scenario and Louis. But the thing that they added in, which didn't come from me, didn't come from him, was 12 months. I have no idea where that 12 months came from. So that was the thing that they added into the mix, which of course created a whole lot of sort of vibes afterwards, right? Because I've been talking 2 to 3 years, not happening in a year. So that's essentially the thing to understand. But The fact is that looking at all the things I went through earlier on, you can see why it is that it looks to me as though home prices are likely to be on their way down. And frankly, I think there's more ahead. It's a question now of how fast and how severe. Now, of course, there are lots of other scenarios you could run. You know, Reserve Bank could go into negative interest rates. There could be massive stimulus. They could blow the assets up to try and support it. We could get more unnatural acts, as well as the bail-in and the bailout. So there you go. That's my sort of summary. Now, I'm happy to take, if you've got more questions on 60 Minutes, I'm happy to talk about that further. But I wanted just to explain how we got to where we got to. Donna's suggesting that they were trying to discredit. I'm not sure they were. I think they actually were trying to tell a story that would actually grab, because that's what they needed to do. And actually, if you look at the statements that I made through the sequence, I don't disagree with anything I said and the way that it was actually presented, other than the 12 months. The 12 months is the interesting question, because the 12 months basically is too quick. This is not going to happen in 12 months. This is going to take 3 or 4 years to work through. Now, Eva's asking, are rental properties looking at rental increases? No. Rentals are more aligned to income than to home prices. That's why rentals are actually pretty much stagnating. If you look at real returns, they're lower now than they've been in almost every centre. We've also got higher vacancy rates. And put that together, I don't see a huge amount of upside in terms of rentals over the next little while. So the fact is that we have all of this downward pressure, right? And the thing about the 60 Minutes thing was we actually went through pretty much all of the main arguments, right, as to why it is that there's more downside than upside. Now, you may have seen Stephen's invites. He bet me, he offered me basically a bet to say that on a sort of a six to whatever basis, that effectively, Geneve's saying, ABC did a piece on rental crisis you mentioned previously. Lack of increase in rents demonstrates there is no housing shortage. Yep, that's probably right. There is no real shortage in housing, by the way. That's one of those sort of little bits of myth. If you think about it carefully, the way it works is this. I'll talk about the other interviews in a second. The way to think about this is we have migration, net migration, about 270,000 over the last 12 months, according to the latest ABS stats. We have about 200,000 units coming on stream over the next 12 months. So that pretty much evens it out. And if you look at the ABS data, the number of people per household, per unit of property, has not changed in a decade. So I am not of the view that there is a significant shortage in houses. And that's why I don't believe that the most significant factor in driving house prices up is migration. That's a bit of a furphy. The critical one thing that drives home prices is credit availability. And I went through the reasons why credit availability is being tightened in one of the earlier slides. Because credit is less available, that's going to continue to drive houses prices lower. And that is not a temporary thing. We are seeing tighter lending standards. We're seeing the banks now being much more forensic in their analysis of applications for loans. Put all that together, lending is going to continue to tighten. And the only way for home prices to go up is for lending to continue to grow as a relative percentage. If it just maintains its current levels, that won't be enough to support prices. If it drops, as it's dropping now, particularly for the investment sector, that's going to drive prices lower. So for me, there's a lot of significance to this situation. That's why I think home prices are still further down. But remember also that my fourth scenario, the Armageddon scenario that we discussed, is actually based on an assumption about something offshore going to happen. So from the US, you know, maybe we'll get corporate failures as the Fed puts rates up and as we get more in the way of a higher costs of debt coming through, because the corporate sector in the US is highly leveraged. So we need some of that to see the 40 to 45. If we don't get that, if it's just a local problem, then we're not going to see prices drop so far. and we're probably going to be in a sort of 15 to 20 or a 20 to 20, 20 to 30 scenario. Still down, but not as much. Okay, now, Argentina has less than a quarter of foreign US denominated debt in proportion to GDP compared to Australia. Does it mean that we might experience 6% interest rates? No, I think it's unlikely that we're going to see rates rise. But if you talk to John Adams, he's got this view of hyperinflation being one of the scenarios that could well emerge if things really start to go off the rails. John may want to put a comment back into the chat on that. Depends on, obviously, how the regulators begin to react and respond. So I going back to Stephen. So basically, Stephen said, would I bet? And I said, no, I won't bet. But what I will do is come and debate on my channel why you think home prices are not going to fall as far or as fast as I do. And he refused to do that. And then he published the bet. So I published my response, and that's how we got the circuit going as to the discussion around the question of, you know, wouldn't I or would I, and why didn't I? So the bottom line is this. We are looking at considerable corrections ahead, but nobody quite knows how quickly or how far. But I find it very, very hard to understand how we could possibly see a home price correction anytime soon in the upside, in other words, moving up again back to where we were, unless we get massive stimulus from the government, massive rate drops from the RBA, and effectively just a kick the can down the road for another cycle. That's what tripped up Steve Keen when he made the prediction of prices falling all those years ago. And of course, as you may know, he ended up walking to Kosciuszko because he lost his bet. I didn't make a bet, so I'm not going to have to walk anywhere. Okay, Michael says, if the USA gets into aggressively raise rates and drive emerging markets, what happens? Yeah, good question. The fact is, we are likely to see two more rate rises in the US this year, one in September, one in December. That will be enough to put considerable pressure on emerging markets, as well as even funding for the banks down here. The capital markets rates will continue to rise. That will put more pressure on everywhere. The emerging markets are where a lot of the pressures are. And in fact, quite interestingly, a lot of the big institutional players who were big investors in the emerging markets up until quite recently have come out of it and are now investing either in the US dollar or in other things. Robert didn't ask me a question. Okay, walk the world is me. Yes, that's correct. How much capacity from a debt perspective? You might have to say at walk the world. Yes, yeah, say at walk the world and then it highlights. Yep, no, that works. Okay. There are pockets that may hold their value, i.e. desirable regional. Yes, I agree. Lazy Postman's asked about, is all prices going to go the same? No, absolutely not. My view is this, that we're going to see the strongest falls in newly built apartments in the main urban centres, particularly in Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane. We're going to see some falls in regional areas, but nowhere near as far because they haven't risen as high. And going back to that fundamental question about how you calculate the cost of value, what's the fundamental value of property? The fundamental value of property is closer to where it currently is in the regional centres, so there's less risk of downside. And I think houses, particularly houses in certain areas, not the top of the market, but perhaps towards the middle and the bottom, will also be less volatile. But we know that in, for example, Ultimo in Sydney, in the last year, units prices on average have dropped 22% there. We know that in other locations, Central Coast, for example, and in and around Melbourne, we've also seen considerable drops. So you've got to go location by location, property type by property type. And Chris Bates, the guy I spoke to the other day, you might have seen his interview. He's a mortgage broker and a financial advisor, made the point, and I want to make it again. We have to think of the property market not as one single market, but as a whole lot of little markets, all behaving a little differently. And the averaging data that we get through indices and those things really don't help much because effectively in a falling market with lower volumes, the indices are less accurate. The valuations of properties are harder to do. So in fact, we're seeing property valuations dropping quite a lot, because now when somebody makes an application for a loan, they put one valuation in, but then before they actually draw the loan down, a further valuation is done, and quite often that valuation is lower. As a result of that, the deal isn't done. How much capacity does the government have from a debt perspective to stimulate the economy? The answer is they have the ability to actually write a lot of money if they wanted to. So if they wanted to blow the debt up, they could. The issue is, there's a few questions I need to go back to there. Hang on. Whoa, there's too many questions. I'm being swamped here. Just a second. Okay. How much capacity does the government have? Yeah, the government can certainly raise a lot more debt. So, but there's a point at which the credit rating begins to look a bit dodgy, right? So remember that as debt rises, you have to be able to repay the interest on the debt. And as interest rates rise around the world, the cost of debt is going to rise. Now, that is going to hit the US because they've got very high debt. It's going to hit us. And so there are some theoretical limits as to how much capacity we have before we start then getting into hyperinflation and those other things. I don't know what that number is. It's quite big, perhaps, but it may not be as big as perhaps we think. Eric asks, have I been knocked back by negative press? No, not really. Basically, nothing that I said I would change. I've corrected the record in terms of what they actually said and the 12 months thing. That's the only thing that I disagreed on. Everything else I stand by. Okay. Now, Crypto Pirate, can you explain to me why we're having inflation and no wage growth? Yep. Few things. Firstly, the exchange rate's dropping, which means that the costs of imports are rising. So think about oil. That's coming in. That's coming in at a higher cost. We've also got considerable prices relating to electricity. I mean, pretty much everybody who's got an electricity bill will have seen it rise considerably. We've got significant rises in the cost of healthcare. We've got considerable rises in the costs of many other things that we actually touch day to day. The CPI, in my view, completely underestimates the truth and reality for most households. Most households that I survey quite a lot, 4,000 each month, they keep saying, this is not my experience. My experience is that costs are rising a whole lot more, and yet incomes are not. And it's that sort of pincer movement. Then you've got big mortgages, you've got slightly rising interest rates. That's just another pressure. That's why the mortgage stress is looking at cash flow rather than any other metric, because what we're trying to do there is to get a complete view of a household's budget. Money in, money out. Can they make the mortgage and pay everything else, or do they actually need to do something different? So that's the basic reason. No wage growth is also driven by the fact that company profits have been growing, but companies have not been feeding that back into more wages. So they've been ratcheting down wages growth. We also have a lot of part-time people employed, often in multiple jobs. And we haven't even things like zero hours contracts where people have no guaranteed hours. So all of that has come together to create a different working environment with less protection, which means that effectively companies can bear down on many employees. And as a result of that, incomes are not growing. And, you know, the only thing to note there is that the public sector wage bill is rising a little bit faster than the private sector. So Canberra wages, for example, are rising faster. That's one reason why house prices in Canberra are a little more buoyant, in my view. Okay, what else have we got in the stream? At what point would Australia lose its AAA rating? What would cause a downgrade? If it was downgraded, would the RBA be forced to hike? Well, the credit ratings agencies, of course, are responsible for making the assessment of the ratings. Now, my own view of credit rating agencies, I'm not sure whether they're really worth the paper they're written on, but that's another story. They would look at the debt, the ability to service debt. They would look at the economic growth prospects and all of those other things. If we lost our AAA rating, a couple of things happen. Firstly, the cost of debt goes up. And secondly, our ability to be able to do some of the other things we want to do would be perhaps curtailed. Remember, of course, also that if the ratings dropped, that would have a flow-on effect into the banking system as well. And so you can't have banks with a higher rating than the country. It's just not possible. So that means that effectively there could be some corrections in the bank sector as well, which would put the cost of borrowing up for the banks. So this if we lose a AAA rating, it could be a big deal. That said, there are many other countries around the world who've lost their credit rating and are still doing reasonably well. So let's not get overventilated about it. But, you know, if we can not go down that route, it's probably a good thing. Okay. People I know are going broke slowly, being swamped by rising expenses. Yeah, that's exactly right. The wage growth has been static for 6, 7, 8, 9 years for many people. So in real terms, after inflation, you know, many people are going backwards. And many people are also still experiencing underemployment. So they don't get the hours they want. They don't actually have the jobs they want. Underemployment is a little bit lower than it was, but it's still very high. And so therefore, there are many people who are saying, gee, this is really tough. I can't find a way to make ends meet. And then they look at their mortgages for payments going up. And then they think, oh, it's really tough, really, really tough. And that's why a million people are in mortgage stress at the moment. And it's going to go on rising because the fundamental trajectory that we're on just leads in that same direction. Okay. What else? Now, let me just talk then about the bail-in once again. So bail-in and bail-out. Here's the theory. The bail-in and bail-out goes back to a decade ago, and we talked about Lehman and all those things a few days ago with Robbie Barwick from CEC, and I did a couple of other posts as well, because, you know, a decade ago there was considerable mayhem in the markets triggered by the fall of Lehman. The thing there was that governments ended up bailing out the banks. So Royal Bank of Scotland, for example, in the UK was basically nationalised, and a lot of other banks around the world were all thrown huge amounts of money, and taxpayers therefore picked up the bill. And those bills were huge, and in many cases they're still being paid off. So post that, the idea was that the banking regulators globally got together and said, we need to find an alternative route because we don't want to have the same bailouts again. And they came up with this bail-in philosophy, which basically says three things. Firstly, banks must have a life support strategy and a crisis management strategy. So if they get caught, they have a plan to deal with it. Secondly, we'll actually create tiers and classes of assets which can effectively be liquidated quickly. And thirdly, and this is where it gets tricky, there'll be some types of assets that can be converted to be able to actually provide additional capital when required. And that's the sort of the concept of bail-in. Now, bail-in basically says you can then use those as part of the mechanism to help with a bank that might be struggling. Right? Now, in New Zealand, there is the most overt example of what that bail-in has come to mean. Because in New Zealand, it's very clear that if a bank gets into crisis, the Reserve Bank in New Zealand is able to effectively bail in other words, grab people's deposits and use those deposits to help support a bank through the crisis, beyond the crisis, and then pay back a proportion of that deposit money back to depositors later. So basically, they're using depositors' money as part of the bail-in package. Now, in Australia, it's no was near as clear-cut. There was legislation earlier in the year brought in under the APRA bill, and there was a clause in there about any other instrument being accessible as part of the bail-in process. Now, any other instrument was defined narrowly by the Treasury and by APRA, suggesting that it was financial instruments of various sorts. But people were worried that any other instrument potentially could be expanded to cover deposits too. And there was an attempt, a last attempt before this bill was nodded through, to try and get a clause inserted to expressly exclude deposits from bail-in. Now that was chucked out. So we have a bill that says any other instrument may be activated as part of a bail-in process. And there is lack of clarity in my mind as to whether the deposits are in or out. Now, of course, APRA is saying, no, we'd never take deposits. However, somebody sent me an interesting piece of information the other day. They got information from a backbencher who specifically said bail-in of deposits could be activated. So it is ambiguous, and I think it's deliberately so, so that effectively it gives them maximum wriggle room in a crisis. And here's the thing. There is a deposit scheme which protects deposit up to $250,000, but only if it's activated by the government, and it's only up to a certain amount in one institution. And that's designed to protect an individual bank, right? But if we had multiple failures, then effectively the total pool that's available to support the deposit system would be insufficient. So again, we have another situation where even the deposit discussion and support may be inadequate given significant scenarios. So then the question is, well, okay, so what do I do if I've got money sitting in the bank? Should I be worried? Probably not in the short term, because I don't think we're going to get a bank crisis in the next 6 months. But down the track, it's worth thinking about spreading the risks, looking at banks that have less risky strategies. There are some smaller banks, some regional banks, some community banks that actually look to me to be firmer and stronger relative to some of the bigger ones. The whole bail-in thing is really messy, and I think it's been made messy deliberately, and I'm not confident in a crisis that all the deposits will necessarily be 100% safe. So that's my bail-in theory. Other people will disagree. Other people say, no, APRA said completely, Treasury said they'll never take deposits. But it's not in writing. It's not totally clear. And the legislation says any other instrument. So there you go. That's the bail-in conversation, which then takes you to, okay, so what do we do? What are the alternatives if bail-in is there? And that's when you get into the conversation about, okay, do I go offshore? Do I go for gold? Do I go for something different? And that's, of course, the conundrum, because there are no real big safe alternatives. Okay, Slavik Mart, do you think Australians will ever work out to stop voting for the Liberal Labour two-party dictatorship? Oh, interesting question. Ooh, don't know. It seems to me that we've got these two sides of politics and they spend all the time chucking hand grenades at each other and forget that actually they're there to serve the broader community, which is why, of course, a lot of micro-parties are getting up. I'm not sure that the two-party system is going to fragment that far, though, but maybe it will. Maybe it should, because at the moment they're doing us very bad service. And the problem is that actually both sides of politics spend way too much time on internal conflicts and throwing rocks across the aisle rather than dealing with the really big things that we should be thinking about. Because there are some very important questions for us as perhaps people in Australia or people looking into Australia about the future of our economy. And it's about this. Where are we going to get growth from? Because we've basically created growth by migration, we've created growth by massive expenditure in construction and in housing and blowing the housing bubble up, but that's not real. You look at the GDP numbers, they're not particularly splash. We have not got a really firm future in terms of where growth is going to come from, and that's the thing I worry about. So that's why I think that something like a people's bank is perhaps worth thinking about. In other words, focusing on investing in those things that will create future growth for the economy, because the current models are just bust. Anyway, that's my view. Sorry, I'm getting a bit political there, but I get hot under the collar on this because it seems to me so blimmingly obvious, blindingly obvious, and yet politicians seem to just go around it all the time. Okay, Ed says, how would Trump's trade war on China affect us? Yeah, I think first order and second order impacts. Global trade is falling. It's dropped, I think, a couple of percent I saw recently because of the trade wars already. Trump tonight announced another $200 million tariffs on China. He's excluded a few different things, but there's still a long list of more than, I think, 5,500 items. This is getting serious now. And the fallout into other markets is now beginning to potentially play out, not only in changing the exchange rate, but also getting other reactions elsewhere. So there is now a real risk of effectively the open trading model that we've had for quite a long time getting effectively crimped and trimmed and becoming less effective. So I think this is a big deal. And I'm certainly concerned by what I'm seeing from the US, because essentially the argument is, I think, that they're going to continue to apply pressure until China capitulates. But I'm not sure that China will capitulate, and therefore this could get quite nasty and quite deep. Okay, a lot of more questions. Let's go here. Any tips for first-hand buyers, Marcin? Okay. Yep, so here's your question. Do you need to buy now? Because if you do need to buy now, there are still some reasonable deals around and you can get the first owner grants. But if you don't need to buy now, it's worth saving more and waiting, in my view, because I think you'll see home prices continue to drive, even at the bottom end of the market. There's going to be a lot more. And that means you may be able to buy in a year's time, say, closer in to the city rather than perhaps right out on the fringe. And you might be able to buy a better property. So my own view is, unless you've got a burning need to transact now, it's probably worth just giving it a little bit more time and seeing how this plays out. There is not going to be any lack of property. There's more property supply coming on. The number of auction clearances are way down. The number of properties coming onto the market are rising. The prices are going to slide. So my view is save more, because if you save more, then effectively you can reduce the LVR, get a better mortgage, and potentially get a better deal later. That would be my own view. That was what I would do if I were a first-time buyer, but your position may be different. Your mileage may vary, but that would be what I would be thinking about. Okay, end central banks pricing money. Yeah, well, interesting question about the role of central banks. So all the central banks, of course, are part of a cartel of central banks, and they all meet and discuss things on the same basis and in the same way. They are still running the same flawed model that basically says that banks start with deposits and then lend money out, and therefore by controlling deposits and those ratios through the BIS, you can actually control lending. It's not true, it's the other way around. Banks create money simply by effectively writing a ledger entry. They create the money, that money then goes into the system and ends up as lifting asset prices, or it ends up going in deposit accounts. It's completely reverse from the way that everybody thinks it normally is. Most central bankers haven't got it. A few have. Bank of England have. A few others have. But it's a big deal to change that philosophy. If you want to know more about that, look at the Steve Keen interview that I did. Where we talked about fluffy icebergs. That was quite a fun session. And we went through that in some detail. So that's worth looking at. Okay. Growth certainly won't come from the car industry, says Sam. I agree with that. We need to find the new engine of growth. It's not, I've got to be careful here, but it's not just putting more jobs into the healthcare sector to support our elderly. It's really important we do that. But that is not going to create more productive output from the country, right? Neither is just digging up raw materials out the ground and shipping it out to China or anywhere else. We have to find a different growth path, and that's probably the biggest challenge that I see. Stagflation says there is no try. Yes, it's certainly feasible. We could see a similar scenario to Japan, where effectively for a long, long time there's been little growth. Now, if you go and visit Japan, they're doing quite well. But it's a very different economy than ours, and I think there are some lessons we can perhaps even learn from them. But yeah, there is a risk, I think, of that. How about you starting a People's Bank? Okay, well, yes. I think there's a real need and a real possibility to do that. Not me personally, but maybe, if we can find a way of doing it. Because we've got to find an alternative banking model than the one that's out there. The Royal Commission showed us just how bad the banking system is and how they just don't take account of their customers. They don't worry about anything other than profit. And I don't think it's feasible for the banks to change their culture and just suddenly become good guys. It's not feasible. So it's tough for me to see how, by keeping the banking system the way it is, we're going to get what we need as a country. And so there's got to be a dialogue going about what the alternatives may be. Now, maybe the Royal Commission will trigger some of that. Maybe it won't. But to my mind, there's a really important discussion to be had here about the future of banking to serve the people and to drive the investment not into more housing and more mortgages, but driving it into productive things. That's what we need. Why does the government need to pay interest on its own legal tender debt for nation building assets? Interesting question about the way that the banking system works and the government works and the fact that it pays debt. The fact is that the interest, of course, is paid on the debt that they borrow. That's just the way it's always been. I suppose they could not do that, but I'm not quite sure whether they get any investors to then take it. So today, a lot of those investments are bought, the bonds are being bought by offshore. It's interesting. Did you know that the banks in Australia, the 15 largest banks in Australia, have a liquidity reserve capacity with the Reserve Bank, which means they don't have to buy these bonds, the government bonds. It's actually cheaper for them not to do that, but to pay the 15 basis points to the Reserve Bank and effectively have the liquidity support that's available there. It's nuts in my mind. That should be removed. We should have our banks investing in the local bonds. I'm not sure that we'd ever see a situation where effectively government debt was zero, although if you think back to the old war bonds years ago in the UK, for example, they were zero coupon. So they were undated. So basically they went on forever and they were then traded at zero coupon. So I suppose there are alternative structures. Okay. Who owns the RBA, says Sam? Good question. The RBA is an entity which, when it makes a profit, hands the money back to the government. The RBA has a mandate from the government in terms of inflation targeting and in terms of its independence. So it's actually legislated. The Reserve Bank is part of this cartel of international central banks that work together and talk to each other. So they have a sort of a groupthink around it. Is it completely aligned with the interests of the economy? Well, they think they're doing the right thing. They think that their strategies are indeed the best and appropriate, the most appropriate way to deal with the issues the country is facing. All of their minutes will say, we're reacting, we're doing the right thing, next rate move will be up. I have to say, if you look back over the last 10 years, I think they've probably stuffed up big time with interest rates. I think they took the rates too low. And I think they're too complacent now about the level of debt in the system and what's going on. But that's how it's set up. So basically, they're independent, but they have the mandate from the government and they pay a dividend back to the government at the end of the year. Okay, Ithrin says, considering the bad economic outlook for all the trade wars and taking into account the bail-in risk, what would an average saver do with his wealth? Good question. So the question is, are you after protection and security? Or are you after growth? Because you may not be able to get both of those. So scenarios would be, if you're after security, then effectively spreading it around and looking for those banks with lowest risk is a reasonable bet, I think. If you're looking for growth, then people will say, well, maybe I should speculate with Bitcoin, for example, or speculate with gold. Those things are, by definition, perhaps volatile. Now, John Adams and I will disagree on this point because John thinks that gold and silver are probably the way to go. I'm less convinced about that. It is not easy. It really is not easy in the current environment to figure out. There is no completely safe haven. If you have physical gold, you've got to store it somewhere. If you've got Bitcoin, then basically you don't know whether it's going to go up, go down. Somebody asked me earlier on, what's my view on Bitcoin? Sitting around 7,000 at the moment. There's very little chance, in my view, that it's going to go up towards 10. Somebody was saying the other day that it might, and I think it could well drop further. I notice, however, that some of the big international investment banks are now starting to get interested in offering various products and services around Bitcoin. So that may give it some support a little later, but I can't see it ever getting back up to where it was in the short term. That's my own view. Okay. Let's have a look. There's a few other comments here. I can't read all of these. I've got okay. Sorry, I'm getting a bit swamped with all of the ramifications of the class action, says Donna. Yeah, great question. Okay. So did any of you see my interview with Roger Brown? So Roger is one of the people who's taking action against the banks in terms of their lending. And of course, there are Slater and Gordon, and there was another one announced today. This is a big deal because basically it's going to really come out now that there will be multiple class actions being taken on various aspects. Now, the question is, how successful are they likely to be? I can't necessarily judge, but I think there's enough evidence from the Royal Commission to suggest that there is actually a grievance there. And if prices continue to slide and people get more difficulty and they make losses, then effectively those losses could really mount up. And as well as those losses being directly hitting the bank's balance sheet, you could have these class actions coming over the top. So I'm quite concerned. I think the stock market is not concerned at the moment, I've noticed. And the overall pricing of banks, if you look at their stock prices, are down a bit, but not a lot. I think they're still overpriced. My own view is we're going to see bank shares continue to drive lower on the back of the class actions. Genevieve says, storing metals isn't such a big worry or drama. It's true, it can be quite small and compact, but you've still got to look after it. If you lose it, you've thought. Okay, you've lost it. Stuart says, what are your thoughts on Mr. Kokakis, economist, offering you 15,000? Okay. Yes. So I did discuss it, but just to go over it again in a bit more detail. So it's interesting that his scenario was that prices will fall, but not as far. So he's not saying prices are going to rise, right? But he's basically saying they're not going to drop as far. And I think it's because he assumes that the Reserve Bank is going to come in and effectively support the economy and support home prices. I'm of the view that they will try that, but it won't be successful because the difference this time is credit. And the rationing of credit, which is the strongest lever by far for home prices. So I am of the view that prices will drop a lot further, which is why I've been talking in my various scenarios. But I said to Stephen, I'm not prepared to make a bet with you because, frankly, I don't bet at all. And I also wasn't very impressed of the sort of the way that he sort of positioned it. But I did say to him, come on the show and we'll talk about it. Let's talk about your views, let's talk about my views, and we can then sort of work out. He refused. So I'm still looking for more bullish economists or property people who with data to argue against me, because I haven't found any yet. There's a lot of high-level opinion and a lot of bullshit out there, but there's no data to support it. The only data that you've got is migration. And like I said before, migration, 275,000 the last 12 months compared with 220,000 or thereabouts, 200,000 units coming on stream the next 12 months. Migration is not going to be sufficient to keep house prices going higher. Foreign investors have been walking away. They might come back a little bit, but I don't think they're going to actually see this as a long-term bet for us. So there is the very little support, and we've got this massive credit tightening. If things get to scenario four, will the RBA bail out the banks? Well, they will certainly have to do something. The question is, will they bail in or bail out, and how will they do it? My own view is we'll end up with the RBA buying mortgage pools off the banks to take some of that pain away. They will probably charge the banks something for doing that. I think there's also a significant chance that liquidity would dry up in this situation. Liquidity is the critical question to understand, right? The reason that Lehman fell over ultimately, and the Royal Bank of Scotland nearly fell over, and Northern Rock, was liquidity. In other words, not being able to get the funds to support their ongoing operations and to support people pulling deposits out of the banks in a timely fashion. Liquidity is the critical thing. If the crisis gets significant here, liquidity is going to be the main thing, because we have banks who are very much reliant on access to the international capital markets. Around 30% of their capital is supported directly from the overseas markets, and about two-thirds of that is actually short-term in duration, under a year. A lot of it's 90-day. So they have this ongoing need to keep those liquidity flows coming in. If people got twitchy and started pulling deposits out, then they need more liquidity. I mentioned the liquidity coverage stuff from the RBA. That's there to help for the 30 days. The real issue is that they would probably have to first guarantee deposits more firmly, in my view. A bit like they did last time around, unlimited guarantee. And secondly, the chances are that some of the banks would have to be split up, bailed out, or otherwise restructured. So
a lot of unknowns there, but I think we can look at the parallels that, you know, from Ireland. The thing on the 60 Minutes was I discussed Ireland in some detail because I think Ireland's a really good parallel to where we are now. And Ireland had banks that were overlent to the housing sector. The banks were claimed to be well capitalized and claimed to be operating perfectly well right up till they fell over. And they were bailed out by government money in the end of the day. I think somewhat similar things are likely to happen here if things go as bad as they could be. Not saying they will, they could. Okay, now let's have a look. Do you think the government will come in with another first homeowner bonus scheme from Robert? Yeah, it's quite likely. The owner schemes in Victoria and New South Wales definitely has brought first-time buyers in. But I'm amazed that first-time buyers see it as something positive, right? Because it's a bribe. It's a bribe to get into the market and buy at the top. Wait, you can buy later, lower, is my argument to that. So they'll try that. I think personally that in the current environment, holding your firepower is probably, though, more sensible. The only growth Australia has seen is people paying more for goods and services. Yeah, you're right, Icetech. In a way, that's the problem, right? We've got this sort of economy where effectively we've got the same amount of money going around maybe a bit faster than before, but we're not creating new stuff. We're not actually creating... I had the chance to visit Germany. I've had the chance to visit some of the Scandinavian countries. They've got a completely different set of economic models as to how to make the economy work. And I think Germany is quite interesting because they've got a very, very strong small business sector and manufacturing sector and a productive industry base. We have not. Fundamentally different. And the Scandinavia is a bit the same. They've actually invested big there. They've got a higher set of taxes than we have here, but they've also got more in the way of social programs, and they've got more in terms of economic capacity than we have. So there are models around if people wanted to look, but we just sort of caught ourselves in this sort of, let's inflate the housing sector a bit more, let's continue to simulate household consumption, and everyone will be fine. Now, it's not going to work. We'll end up in a pretty bad place, in my view. Okay, let's have another more questions. Am I related to Chuck Norris? No. Where did that come from? That's from that unpronounceable name. I don't know what you're getting at there. Ah, the Clive Palmer economy. He should be proud, says he. Okay. So Aldi says, gold miners cannot operate at these prices. There is a bottom in the gold price, not just the COMEX, which dictates supply. Yeah, there's a lot going on around gold. We probably should do a separate video or a separate show on gold because I think there's a lot to say there. How real is the current price? How much are certain banks hoarding gold? How much is the gold price artificially low at the moment? All those interesting questions. Can't really discuss it now, but maybe another time. Darcy said, have I read Ray Dalio's Big Debt Crisis? Yes, I've read some of it, and I think he's got a lot of really interesting points. Look, the fact is, debt is the problem, and it's not just our problem, it's a global problem. The amount of debt in the system, whether you look at household debt, or whether you look at corporate debt, or if you look at public debt, is just ginormous. We've actually inflated the whole planet from a debt perspective. And we can't go on doing that because effectively at the end of the day, you run out of elastic. And, you know, we're seeing that in Australia now. So it's fundamentally, the question is, what is the alternative, right? And that takes us then to discussions about, well, what are the alternative economic models that may actually sort of put on a different footing, right? Because we have to have an alt-control-delete here and reset the economy in some way. Trouble is, we can't probably do it alone. We probably need more consensus around the world to do this. And at the moment, there's no consensus to do it, particularly with Trump and the White House. So that's a real problem. But the problem is that we've just continued to keep the debt cycle going. The fundamental philosophy of the debt cycle is boom and bust is fine. It's just part of the way the economy works. And there are huge consequences and people get hit, you know, left, right and centre on the way through. But that's no alternative. That's just the way the economy is. I don't believe it. It's engineered into the system, the way the system is currently designed and built. It doesn't have to be like that. But we have to understand that if we go a different route, then we can't expect capital growth from property. We can't expect more and more mortgage debt to be building. Different model, different outcomes, different expectations. So this will be a different way of thinking, but maybe a more sustainable way, which is personally, I think, pretty important. Things are going to get interesting as the drought gets more and more established too. I agree, you know. Yes, I think the drought, people haven't really understood the implications of the drought yet, but I agree, another factor in driving the economy down. Debt will always be part of our society. I agree, Icetech, I think you're right. But what's interesting, if you talk to a lot of younger people, they've got a different set of philosophies. They are buying less of this, I'll borrow as much as I can and, you know, get it all now. I think there's a different set of values beginning to come through. I also think that many of them start out with hex debt and other debts. So almost from day one, they've got these massive debts to start with, so they've got less capacity. And of course, income is not growing as fast. We have a generation, though, of people with massive amounts of debt. And the thing I'm worried about is there are a lot of people who are now moving into their 50s and 60s and into retirement with masses and masses of debt. And frankly, no ability to be able to handle it. I'm really concerned about that because effectively at the end of the day, people are going to go to the grave with massive debts. And I'm not sure that's healthy or good. We have had unsound money since 1971. How much longer can the system last? Good question. It will last longer than we think. But I think there are cracks appearing left, right and centre. So it goes back to my scenarios, right? So you can have local issues or we can have global issues. We can have the trade wars, or we can have some international crisis, or we can have this sort of slow grind of debt. But there's a point. There's a point at which not you can do, I guess. If you were in Phil Lowe's position, what would you do hypothetically? So this is Neil B. Well, I have to say, if I was in Phil Lowe's shoes, I would have not ended up with perhaps the debt and the low interest rate we had. But let's assume he came in and it was there. We have to find a way to crimp debt harder, I think. So I'd be looking to reduce the amount of lending. I don't think lending should be anything above inflation for the domestic situation. So there will be tighter lending standards, firstly, and I know that will put pressure on. Secondly, I will be thinking about some strategies around dealing with those people who've got loans they shouldn't have got on bases that they should never have been made. And I'd work with the banks to restructure those loans to make them affordable and sustainable. I think there are ways we could do that. And it could even be as, this is out on the limb now, this is just my sort of 2 cents worth, right? Well, what would happen if we actually, at a set date, decided to reset the value of property and reset the value of the loans on those properties to a sustainable level? And we basically wrote down the loans and we wrote down the value of those properties so that effectively the ratio of loan to property was actually more sustainable. And it was therefore more in line with people's ability to service those loans. If you did that, you'd have the basis potentially for starting off again. And if you put different sets of controls and management systems in place, you could actually stop the inflation. And that's the last point. I don't think inflation targeting at 3% is actually right, because what you're doing is you're building in continued growth, and continued growth is a furphy. So those are some of the things I think about. That's why I would never be invited to be a Reserve Bank governor, because I'm not traditional enough in my ways of thinking. Okay. Do you think a good rule of thumb of when houses are a fair price is that you can buy in the same price as monthly rent? Yes, Ed, I think there's a good point there, that there should be some equation between renting and buying and buying and renting. If you look at some other countries, there's a lot more people who are renting compared to Germany, for example, to buying. And in fact, the economic cost for each of them is actually relatively similar. But there isn't this inflation in capital values. The problem we've got is that houses are seen as an asset, as a form of investment. And effectively, conveniently somewhere to live, but the real reason to hold a house is to get capital growth for the future. That's the mistake we made, the financialization of property. What we need to do is to get back to seeing property as a place to live. If you did that, you could actually change the game. A lot of pain in the way, though, because a lot of people have got these paper profits and thinking, oh, I've had this massive, you know, wealth generation capacity in my property for 20, 30 years. It's artificial. All that's happened is money's been devalued, assets have inflated, nothing has really got better in the process, in my view. John Adams will probably be proud of me at this point. Okay. Anthony says, oh, missed it. Something about 200%. And then I missed it, sorry. Anthony Brown, that sounds like a debt jubilee. Yeah, sort of, yes. I think we've got to find a way. We need a reset button. People will not be able to pay off the debt they've got. They just can't. It's too much. It's too big. They don't have the money to do it. We've got to find a way to break that circuit. Otherwise, we're just going to grind ourselves and the economy and households into the ground, in my view. Somebody says, off topic. Missed that. When you write a book, can I get a signed copy? Yeah. I'm not sure I'm going to write a book. I think that this YouTube channel will actually be my legacy. So there will be a lot of material. And, you know, if we see the crash and what have you, people can go back and say, see, he told you so. I may write a book. I'm not sure. John Adams, Melbourne is also happening. Details are being confirmed. Not sure what that means. I missed the earlier conference. Have you read Dick Smith's book on population crisis? Why do we need to have constant growth? I agree, we don't. My view is we need to grow sustainably now. There needs to be a sustainability target rather than just a growth target. We can't go on inflating the number of people on the planet forever, because basically, you know, there isn't enough resources. We're already seeing that in major areas. We need a different philosophy. And I think it's about quality of life, not quantity of life. And I think it's about dealing with some of those broader philosophical issues. It's the only way, by the way, that we're going to end up with a planet that's livable in a generation or two. So it's pretty critical. Houses are never investments. Oh, Eric, that's a heretical comment. Most people, if you ask them about their property, the first thing they will talk about is how much it's gone up in value. You do the test next time you go around the barbecue. It's always the big question. Okay, well, we're at 9:19, so I'm running pretty long and hot. I'm just going to go back to the presentation and just go through a couple of last quick points and then go to any last comments that we might have. So let me just go to there. Okay, so just a couple of last-minute things. If you're getting value from what we do, particularly on this channel and through the blog, please do consider the Patreon thing. I know I keep saying it, but I spend much, much more time now doing the blog and all the research around the blog than I ever intended. As a result of that, my other businesses are not getting the intention. People are actually really being helpful and supporting what I do. It's a way of allowing me to help you. So if you get value from what I've been talking about, do consider putting value back. Patreon is there. People have also asked me whether I'm going to do anything with an Australian alternative, like PayPal or something. I'm looking at it, but it's really quite complicated to do. So not immediately, but maybe later. The other point to make is just on some recent videos. These are some of the ones that have been the most popular. The Property Imperative Weekly are my weekly summary, still the most popular thing that I put out. Do it every week on a Saturday. Summary of everything that's been going on. I find that a really useful thing myself, so I'll continue to do that. There was the discussion with Robbie Barwick on Lehman Brothers 10 years on, what it's mean for Australia. If you've not seen that and you really want to understand what really happened, do look at that. We've started the capital markets series, so I'm going to do a series there on the capital markets and how they work. If you don't understand about how capital markets work, that's a really good thing to be doing, and there'll be more in the next 2 or 3 weeks. John Adams, of course, and I continue to collaborate. John's done some great series. You may not always agree with him, but that's not the point. It's about getting some of this debate happening. There's a really good presentation that he did with me on a disaster set of results, looking at the GDP numbers and talking about what was behind them. That's a very popular one. I've started, as you know, a series with Professor Jill North on credit regulation. People, I think, have found that really interesting as well, so that's good. And we'll continue to try and get other people on the channel. The Our Iceberg's Fluffy Steve King conversation has been significant in terms of its sort of impact, and quite a few people have watched that. So just a few hits there. There'll be more. Somebody's suggesting put up a crypto code for donations. Okay, I'll look into that. Could you set up a payment scheme more like Steve King with low monthly fee? You give too much away for free, by the way. Okay. Now, that's very interesting, you see, because I am of the view that I want to try and keep as much of this as free as possible. I'd be interested in your view. If I started putting more of this behind the paywall, what would your reaction be? Be interested in your views. Somebody's talked about pork bellies. Yes, yes. Pork bellies. Yes. Seen the movie. It's a great movie. So, interesting question. What I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to allow people to have as much access to my thinking and my ideas as I can for free. And then there are a few different structures within Patreon, from not very much through a little bit more. You can actually put a dollar, you know, that's the bottom, as it were. If you put a little bit more in, then you get access to some other stuff that is there and not here. But I'm not necessarily going to do the sorts of things that Steve Keen does, where he says, well, you know, if you pay a very large amount, then you can get a signed copy of the book and stuff. I don't think I'm going to do that, but still thinking about it. Okay, yes, so how to send donation via live stream. And there was virtualizer. We should be able to do it somehow. I'm not sure. We should be able to click here and make it happen. Put a QR code on. Yeah, okay. You will make more money doing it. Yeah. To my mind, this isn't about making money, frankly. This is about helping to inform and educate. And, by the way, have fun, because I really enjoy doing this stuff as well. But there are costs involved, so that's the way I've done it. Okay, content after a paywall. As I say, content after a paywall, after you've reached critical mass. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, we'll see. As an AMIS model, you need to expand, and then it makes sense to start putting up paywalls and providing more in-depth. Yes, maybe. So I'm not sure. I'm making this up as I go along. Remember, I've only had Patreon up for a couple of months, and hitting 5K this week was amazing. I never thought I'd do that. So, yeah, it's pretty amazing. Right, so I'm just going to have a look at any... Okay, Colin says, any sort of environmental ecological factors do you include with any of your economic analysis? The answer is that I'm very interested in and passionate about the environment and the environmental aspects. I find it hard to sort of segue everything in. If I had more time, I would. I actually, 30 years ago, led some of the first environmental programs in the UK with the banks in the UK, believe it or not, to help them think about why environment was not an add-on. It was actually a fundamental part of their business, and it could be a fundamental part. So, you know, I've been in there early, but I understand the question and point you're making there, Colin. Okay. That's what else? Where do I stand on global warming? The science is in. There's no doubt in my mind that it's real. It's been created by man-made activity, and that we are very close to a tipping point, which will make it very hard to maintain a sustainable life for next generations down the track, unless we get our act together. And it's been politicized to bilio, and I'm absolutely shamed by the stupidity within the political parties here and around the world at not getting serious about it. Native cash rate, somebody's asking. Yes, could well happen. The theory, I think, is, John, I think, spoke about this in one of his presentations, the theory is that it could well be that when things get really bad, effectively, RBA cuts rates and could even go negative. Certainly feasible. If you could create a 60-minute program on any official topic, what would you choose and why? It would be how to live debt-free. Debt-free. Because debt is the problem. The biggest issue around the world is that debt has become an end in itself. The financial system has become an end in itself. If we actually turned off debt, that would actually be a significant change. Okay, well, somebody's asking me about Argentina and Turkey in the emerging markets. I'm not sure that I can necessarily cover that today. I think I'm running close to 9:30 and I really need to pull the pin. I'll take a note of these other questions and we can always... Okay, may I ask which industry are you working in? Who's that aimed at? No, it's not. It's somebody else, I think. I'm not sure I understand that question. It takes me 1 hour to watch 60 minutes. Very good, Eric. Very good. The RBA won't cut, says Bruce. They may be forced to. We'll see. They would love to raise rates. And Gold Reward says if they go negative, I buy gold. Fair enough. Either I pay rent on a property to a landlord or pay rent on money to a bank. Zero-sum game, in my opinion. Particularly if there's no capital gain, you're correct. That's the situation in Germany. That's why that's so interesting. Okay, so I want to say thank you all very much for spending some time with me. I hope you found this useful. I hope that we've covered some new ground as well as perhaps some of the old ground. I hope that you will continue to follow the channel. Please spread the word. I'm really appreciative for all those of you who actually have told other people about what we're doing here. Please do that. Please continue that because that's really important. I will continue to develop great content. I've got a whole bunch of additional interviews planned in the weeks and months ahead. We've got a whole range of different topics as well. And somebody, Genevieve, has asked, can you do a podcast on Ireland experience? Make it a whole show? Yes. Well, I did do that in one of my imperatives, but we could actually look at Ireland in more detail because there's a lot of lessons. And like I say, we're Ireland 2.0. Everything that was happening there is happening here. So thank you very much for watching. I appreciate all of your participation, all of the comments. I'm sorry if I missed any particular comments. I had a lot here tonight. I'm not sure how many we've actually had on. Total viewing time, 484 hours. Peak concurrent, 411. So that's not bad, is it? It's better than last time. So thank you very much. Have a great evening. And I'll look forward to catching up with you soon. There'll be another of these sessions in about a month's time. I tend to pick a Tuesday because it's the day that the Reserve Bank minutes comes out. So I'll look forward to seeing you then. Have a great evening. And thanks very much for spending time with me. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off.